Good morning. I would like to join in welcoming you to the first of the series of the CAPE lectures and to ask you to join me in welcoming Dr. Nimat Hafez Barazangi. She's going to speak to us today from the topic of why Muslim women are reinterpreting the Quran, a transformative scholarship and activism. As is indicated in this title, our speaker of the morning is very much a scholar activist in her own right. She has a number of long-time affiliations with our university. She received her PhD here, studying in the fields of education and Arab studies, as well as in adult and community studies. Before that, she studied at Columbia University and at the Damascus University. She has been affiliated as well with the Program on Feminist Gender and Sexuality Studies, previously Women's Studies, as well as the previous program in Gender and Global Change, and the more recent program, or before that even, Program on Women and International Development. She has received a number of awards, including two Fulbright Awards, an initial one and then a senior one, in which she consulted as well with the Ministry of Higher Education and with universities in the areas of curriculum development and higher education. Her publications are many, and they include a book that is very closely related to the topic that she will share with us today. She has a number of other publications. She's spoken widely at Cornell, in Ithaca, in New York State, in the region, and the country, as well as internationally. We are indeed quite privileged to have her join us in the presentation this morning. So please join me in welcoming Nimat.
Well, good morning and assalamu alaikum. May peace be upon you. I'm quite honored to be invited to this highly intellectual gathering, and especially honored by the presence of President Emeritus of this university. Thank you all for being here. I'm already getting nervous because I'm so passionate about this subject. And please do not feel threatened by my strong presentation. I'm only expressing the work that I've been doing, or the lack of response about the work that I've been doing for the past 40 years. And hence, I'm very passionate about it. As I stated earlier, may peace be upon you and upon this nation and this university, because we are in a turmoil. I'm especially grateful for this opportunity to converse with you all, and thanks Sally McConnell-Janelle for her invitation. Unfortunately, she is in Japan now, and for Cindy for her administrative support, and for Josephine for her generous introduction. I'm going to give a summary of the main points of my lecture. Then I will proceed with some details, so you may see some repetition. I'll speak for about 40 minutes, then I'll be happy to take some questions at the end. And excuse me for trying to look into my paper because my passion sometimes takes me off the subject, so I want to stick to it. In my recent lecture at the California Commonwealth Club titled, Why Muslim Women Must Reinterpret the Quran, I began with this statement, quote, the time has come for Muslim women to move from the peaceful, silent revolution that's firmly grounded in the Quran into an open struggle against injustice, end of quote. One of the first questions that I received was, quote, what is the mechanism to guarantee a peaceful, just interpretation of the Quran? My answer was, it is the responsibility of the community to guard against unjust and violent interpretations. But, I added, when the community codifies a particular interpretation, it becomes the responsibility of each individual Muslim to stand up to upholding the Quranic rules of interpretation. In this answer, I wanted to reassert that the crisis is in understanding Islam vis-a-vis Muslims. I also wanted to emphasize that because of this crisis, the majority of the 800 Muslim women have lost their identity and identification with the Quran to the point of losing the moral courage to stand up to their rights as autonomous entities with intellectual, social, and religious responsibilities. In today's lecture, Why Muslim Women Are Reinterpreting the Quran, I would like to further emphasize and expand on the crisis in understanding Islam by both Muslims and non-Muslims. Given the recent politically charged debate on Muslim women's attire and the building of Islamic centers, particularly in Lower Manhattan. These debates are, sadly, the closest thing to anti-Semitism because they indicate a massive ignorance that generates hatred similar to what ignited Nazism. My goal here is both philosophical and practical. It is philosophical, as I was reminded recently by a close colleague of what the philosopher Nietzsche once said, quote, people would rather believe than know, end of quote. The practical aspect is the urgency for a transformative process beyond dialogue or reform. What is needed is to address the premises on which people with blind beliefs were built, given that the core problem within the current debate is misinformation in addition to ignorance, such as the false assumption that a mosque is to be built on ground zero and the propagation that the Quran incites violence to enhance calling for it to be burned in a church whose name ironically starts with the word Dav. Therefore, the time has come for us as academicians to question what has been taught about Islam and to reflect on what has been missing in the study of Islam and to reflect on what has been missing in the study and understanding of Muslim women in our own institutions. Since the politics of difference in our society does not allow a move beyond the double standards in viewing different belief systems, it is time for us to recognize the relationship between the knowledge about Islam that has been imparted and its long-range effect on the populace beliefs. Similarly, given that most past reform movements in Muslim societies have failed And since one of the core problems in the globalization of democracy movement is the absence of Muslim women in shaping and developing Islamic thought, the time has come for a revolutionary move to build a new structure of Muslim societies and communities through an egalitarian interpretation of the Quran as the primary and the only divine source of Islam. The new structure and understanding for the foundations and teaching and learning Islam must materialize before we can claim any change and before women can regain their identity with the Quran in order to retake their principal role in the community. Let me explain. In the debate about the Islamic Center in Lower Manhattan, it was not mentioned that the leading person in the development of the Cordoba Initiative, that's the name of the center, or proposed center, the main person is Ms. Daisy Khan, and she is the founder and the executive director of the American Society for Muslim Advancement, or as abbreviated in the name ASMA, the purpose of which is to dismiss fear and misunderstanding of Muslims and Islam that have been circulating since 9/11/2001. Ms. Khan also happened to be the founder and the executive director of the internationally known organization WISE, or Women's Islamic Initiative in Spirituality and Equality. Though her work with Cordoba Initiative, I'm sure, is linked to her promotion of ASMA and WISE goals, the perception of Muslim women as followers of their husbands and had blinded the media and everyone involved from recognizing these important relations in Khan's work. Even when Christian Amanpour wanted to quell the storm of bias against Muslims and Islam, she introduced Ms. Khan on ABC this week as the wife of Faisal Abdul Rauf. Why didn't Amanpour introduce Khan as the executive director of ASMA and or WISE while she introduced Rabbi Joyce Levitt during the same interview as the executive director of the Jewish Community Center? This example reminds me also with a specific event that took place on this campus 20 years ago. At the time when Cornell scholars were encouraged to design courses for diverse perspectives, I was accused of fundamentalism and of proselytizing Islam because I proposed to teach a course on Muslim women from the Muslim woman's perspective. By reinterpreting the Quran, therefore, we Muslim women scholar activists are transforming the conventional understanding of Islam and the dynamics of Muslim thinking. By changing our perception of ourselves from complementary secondary role to a primary role, we hope to change the perception of Islam as chapter 13 of the Quran states, quote, God will not change the conditions of people until they change what is in themselves, end of quote. Thus, we are bringing a wake-up call to the world as a whole by implementing a fundamental aspect of the social contract between Muslims and Islam, namely to change from within. Indeed, this must be the first essential step toward accomplishing comprehensive human rights for ourselves and toward the much-needed challenge to the unwarranted authority held by Muslim men for 14 centuries, as well as the authority of teaching about Islam by non-Muslims. Jocelyn Cesari, the director of Islam and the West program at Harvard and Johns Hopkins Universities, stated in an article recently titled, quote, "Islam is a religion, not a terror ideology." She stated, "Scholarly literature often echoes stereotypical images of Islam and Muslims. In some cases, headlines come directly from titles in academic journals and books like, quote, 'The Muslims Are Coming, The Muslims Are Coming' by Daniel Pipes, or 'The Root of Muslim Rage' by Bernard Lewis, and 'The Crisis of Islam, Holy War and Unholy Terror' by Bernard Lewis as well." End of Jocelyn's quote. Thus, our strife is not as simple as it sounds when we are working against the views that made the majority of Muslim women imperiled, perpetual minors, a religious burden, socially and morally dependent creatures, and almost intellectually and intuitively nil. While we are bringing in a French perspective on Islam to move away from the gross misunderstanding of Sharia, for instance, the Dean of Orientalists at Princeton University, Bernard Lewis, demeans the field of Islamic studies by such catchy titles. Furthermore, the United States and European governments do not feel ashamed of implicitly agreeing recently with Hamid Karzai's intended compromise with the most extremist, ultra-extremist, the Taliban, even accepting their version of what's wrongly called Islamic Sharia. Obviously, Muslim women will pay the heavy price if that happens. Therefore, a change in premises, perceptions, and attitudes on the ground is overdue for both Muslims and non-Muslims. In making such strong assertions, I wanted to set the tone of urgency of this crisis, beginning on this campus and as far away as the cave of the Taliban. Let me first detail the problem, the context, and possible solutions. I will then present some facts and statistics to analyze those suffocating attitudes and practices concerning women and the study of Islam. Finally, I will touch on whether Muslim women's interpretation of the Quran have or have not helped. It should be clear that today I am neither presenting a theoretical model nor discussing a theological treatise. I'm merely analyzing the centuries-old sociological and cultural phenomena from within the Quranic ethical and pedagogical framework. The problem. Let me repeat. The problem is not with Islam nor with the dictators and extremist groups, but with the representation of Islam in general. Therefore, I begin by questioning what have been taken for granted. True, Muslim societies have not awakened to the reality that a human development is is a process that is based on balancing a belief system with its interpretation. Yet non-Muslims who think that they are helping do not realize that they are adding to the problem because they often separate knowledge from the value system. The end results in both cases are more representations of Islam and more conflict. How? When I was asked recently to review a legal memorandum on divorce in Islam that was written by a graduate student at the law school for the benefit of judges in developing countries on gender justice, I was enthusiastic to see that some aspects of Islam are being introduced at the law school here. The memorandum began with the definition of quote-unquote Islamic law as synonymous with quote-unquote Islamic Sharia. I was perplexed. How could such an understanding produce justice for women when one of the most fundamental aspects of a Muslim woman's life is determined by someone who does not know the difference between Sharia and what is known in the West as Islamic law? Obviously, the student was following what has been taught at the school and probably at the university for decades without being questioned. The magnitude of the problem here requires more than just me explaining the difference to the person who asked me to review the document or to the student. The problem is embedded in the premises on which the discipline of Islamic studies is based. Sharia in Islam is the path or the guidance of the Quran in its totality, and not the collection of rules derived by jurists or interpreters that were solidified by Western colonials under the term Islamic law. I repeat, Sharia in Islam is the path or the guidance of the Quran in its totality. The Quran states, quote, "Then we put thee on Sharia," or the path, "so follow that way and follow not the desires of those who know not," end of quote. What we need, therefore, is to critically examine the commonly used meanings of Islam, whether by Muslims or non-Muslims. Islam is neither a law nor a dogma of submission, as Muslims generally translated. Rather, Islam is a religious, moral, rational worldview. I repeat, Islam is neither a law nor a dogma of submission, because submission means dissolution of responsibility from awareness and understanding the deep meanings of the Quran in order to practice it responsibly. Unfortunately, the confusion between Sharia and what is wrongly called Islamic law is magnified on signs reading, quote, unquote, "no Sharia" that are being held by the demagogues who were protesting against the Qurtuba initiative and the building of mosques in other places. These signs might have also instigated vandalism to the mosques in Tennessee and California, because people fear the ambiguous, especially when it's built on prejudice. The view of Islam as a law seems to be influenced by the Jewish view of the Talmud as much as it is influenced by the church missionary emphasis on elite male leadership supported by the colonials. We see a more harming result of such imperial act when the United States government interfered in drafting the Iraqi constitution in 2005, allowing for extremist Muslim clerics to slip in specific quote-unquote Muslim rulings as the basis for developing any new law in Iraq. Such rulings are those that have harmed women in the past, and what motivated Iraqi women in 1959 to struggle for removing these rules from Iraqi personal law. The 1959 law was upheld even by the dictator Saddam Hussein, yet the US government gave itself the privilege for such a change in order to protect its own interest. What right have it in doing so? Similarly, and this example was used before on this hall, and I would like to repeat it in more details, used by my colleague here. Similarly, the Archbishop of Canterbury's statements in February 2008 is an example of a well-intended gesture, but that represents misunderstanding the difference between the Islamic guiding principles of the Quran and what is known as Islamic law. When he suggested that the British lawmakers should come to, quote, accommodation with some aspect of Muslim law as we already do with aspects of other kinds of religious law, end of quote, the Archbishop made a gross miscalculation because the present legal systems that some Muslims want to transplant in the West consist of predominantly centuries-old interpretations and customary practices by Muslim males that were made into law with the support of the colonial common laws to subdue the conservative Muslim male leaders of the time. That's what's happening now in Iraq and Afghanistan. History is repeating it, sadly, in the most negative way. The Archbishop's statement is not different, and it also represents dire implications, not only for England, but for Muslims and non-Muslims around the globe. Has he forgotten the hardship that women have been suffering since similar rulings were imposed on Muslims and other religious groups by the British and other colonials during the 19th and 20th centuries? Being an educator specialized with the foundations of Arabic and Islamic studies and concerned with gender justice, I think that it is fair to claim that as long as Islam is being studied with the tools of Orientalism, that is treating Islam as subject of study stamped with an otherness, the West will never be able to understand Islam, nor help Muslim women. The West does not see these women as citizens in their own right, nor realize that such women and Muslims in general are already an integral element in the new West. The assumptions that Islam is a foreign religion and that needs to be interpreted by others telling Muslims how to understand their own belief system to the point that a Jewish professor on this campus conducted a Quranic study circle for Muslim students. Unbelievable. And telling Muslims where they should or should not practice it to the point that they are threatened by burning the Quran, these assumptions and act further marginalize Muslim women and bring more misunderstandings. Hence, there will never be a reformation movement in Muslim societies like what happened in Europe, because the structure of Muslim societies and their aspirations are different. The social structure is built on the extended family social collaboration model, not on the nucleus economic-based model. While the aspirations are mostly related to past history and traditional authority morality, not to nationalistic or ethnic morality. The time has come for us and for a revolutionary move to build a new structure for Muslim societies and communities through an egalitarian interpretation of the Quran that restores the religio-moral rational authority of interpretation to each individual Muslim. We would be able to have a peaceful and just Muslim society only by using two basic Quranic principles: observing the natural order of the world and developing action plans by means of educated reason and mutual consultation. Let me bring some statistics and the attitudes surrounding them. On the occasion of the International Women's Day in March 2010, the Revolutionary Afghan Women Association stated that Afghan women are mourning for the gang rape of many women, for being flogged, for being auctioned in open market, and for their young daughters who put an end to their miserable lives in their own hands. In 2008, the Iraqi Women Ministry reported that since 2003, out of each four marriages in Iraq ended in divorce. In addition, in a recent BBC report, the head of the Iraqi Amal Association stated, Iraq has 1 million widows who have no economic support for them and for their estimated 4 million orphans beyond the social welfare payment of less than $50 a month. Not counting the 4 million Iraqi refugees and the hundreds of thousands who died and injured, I wonder if this is the kind of civil disintegration that Madeleine Albright called civilian collateral damage. Or is it a worthwhile price for George W. democracy? These facts and statistics concern me more when I hear and read false reports of liberating Afghani and Iraqi women after the invasions. My concern here is not only with the concrete facts per se, as much as with the perceptual and attitudinal stand underpinning such reports about Muslim women. The problem is twofold. On the one hand is the stigmatization of Muslim women as the helpless group that needs outside help, as if their misery is not related to the wheels of militarized politics that's being grinded with the support of our think tanks. On the other hand, the majority of Muslim women who experience these situations often are told that they are being liberated by removing the veil and by going to beauty parlors to do their hair and paint their fingernails. These women have no clear solutions to their pathetic condition either, nor the capacity to change their lot, mainly because they are oppressed by their lack of skills and by distorted knowledge of those who claim to liberate them. Their pathetic conditions are further complicated by the fact that they do not realize that their knowledge of Islam relies on secondary conflicting sources instead of relying on the Quran. They may recite the Quran many times during daily prayers, asking for God's help, but they have been mostly absent from extracting meanings directly from the Quran by themselves and for themselves in order to challenge false representations of Islam. Such representations are those that resulted in segregating men and women, secluding women in the name of modesty, and sometimes preventing them from accessing educational institutions, discouraging or preventing them from congregational prayer and communal decision-making, but above all, denying them the direct identification with the Quran as an autonomous person. In other words, they have been absent from the decision-making process in which representations of Islam and themselves have been developed largely by Muslim males and partially by non-Muslims. It is fair, therefore, to suggest that Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, would be amazed at the current perceptions of Islam and at the Muslims' practice of it, because people foil Islam in the images of their own beliefs. The sad part is that most Muslims, regardless of their university education, have also brought in the idea that Islam is a private religion They have bought in the idea, thinking that by merely imitating and the image and reported actions of the Prophet, that they have mastered their religious duties and fulfilled their Islamic identity. Although the Quran instructs, quote, take what the messenger has brought you and leave what he prevented you from doing, the problem is that Muslims came to codify all reported sayings and actions attributed to the Prophet, whether authentic or not, viewing them as sacred as the Quran, to the point of missing the basic Quranic message that the Prophet had carried for 22 years between 610 and 632. By elevating these traditions from their second place as a source of Islam, known as Hadith or Sunnah, to the same level of the Quran being the primary source, they have violated the message of the Quran of no deity but God. Maysam al-Farouqi says, the Quran reminds us that it is not because of the Prophet Muhammad that Muslims accept the Quran, but because of the Quran that they have accepted the authority of the Prophet. In addition, while the Prophet as an agent of change was willing to take a risk by challenging the common sense knowledge of the time, the majority of today's Muslims are not willing to abandon the certain old interpretations of Islam that are misleading and unjust, and replace them with egalitarian intention as outlined in the only divine source, the Quran. Hence, it is also fair to state that the true message of Islam concerning women has rarely been practiced for the past 14 centuries. It is fair, let me repeat, that the true message of Islam concerning women has rarely been practiced for the past 14 centuries because most representations of Islam are based on the reported traditions and without being corroborated with the Quran. Consequently, the search for understanding Muslim women cannot be separated from understanding historical events that surround them. Neither can it be completely secularized or viewed separately from the belief system it represents. It is next to impossible for a non-Muslim mind to comprehend any Muslim phenomenon without trying to find a representation in his or her own belief system, even when she uses an unreligious model. Likewise, it will be next to impossible for a Muslim male to explain issues without retrieving past interpretations developed by male jurists who rely mainly on reported prophetic traditions. Hence, we Muslim women scholar activists are reinterpreting the Quran with a Quranic frame of reference that does not propagate old interpretations. We are leading this process of identifying with the message of the Quran, interpreting on our own in order to understand Islam beyond rituals and to rethink the message of Tawheed, or there is no deity but God. We need to understand this message in order to implement it fully in time and place. To conclude, have Muslim women's interpretation of the Quran helped? Intimate reading of the message of the Quran that the Prophet carried for 22 years continue to be missed even by some Muslim female leaders, including Ingrid Mattson, the first Muslim female president of ISNA, or the largest Muslim organization in North America. When she became president in 2006, she did not lead the co-educational prayer, congregational prayer, with the excuse that there was no precedent in the prophetic tradition. This is not only perplexing, but it is frightening. First, there was a precedent, And there is no specific narrative that prevents women from leading co-ed congregational prayer. Second, even if there was such a narrative, Dr. Mattson seems to have forgotten that the Quranic meaning of khilafa, or trusteeship, is not limited to ritualistic, political, or social leadership, but starts with the congregational leadership, being the most important process of educating for change in premises and perceptions. We should remember that the Quran was the only written source during the life of the Prophet Muhammad and for more than 100 years after his death and before his biographies and traditions were collected. As the second source of Islam, again called Hadith or Sunnah, these traditions, essential as they may be, the majority of which were abused by male interpreters, like what is happening with regards to attire and seclusion. We should also remember that when we talk about religious revivalism, Muslims are not alone in experiencing identity crisis. According to Oliver Roy, this identity crisis is in response to, quote, unquote, the post-cultural society and is the foundation of contemporary religious revivalism, not only among Muslims, but also among other religious groups. Moreover, my research findings suggest that this religious revivalism among fundamentalists, Christians, Jews, and others is one of the factors that incited Western Muslims to adopt fundamentalist views which traveled east. Thus, the rush of the neo-scholars of Islam to attribute fundamentalist and extremist views to a particular Muslim order or author, to one Muslim country, or to one people, or to Sharia, needs to be put to rest. This is the second essential step in rethinking the crisis in understanding Islam and Muslim women. The conditions during the last decade of the 20th century were favorable and helped me and the majority of Muslim scholar activists to challenge the hijacked Islamic authority by Muslim males. Thus, we have declared ourselves an independent authority in Quranic sciences, hoping that these transformative solutions will bring a meaningful reform for Muslim societies, a reform that entails building a new structure based on Islam as a worldview that seeks egalitarian justice through mutual consultation of the entire community. My feeling is that our reinterpretation of the Quran has helped raising consciousness of some, but we still have a long way to go despite the certain path that we choose to take. Why? I will only list three reasons and then close. First, our authority to interpret the Quran was hijacked by some Western fundamentalist groups when they intercepted our implementing the new meanings into actual change on the ground. The Western groups instigated their governments to preempt the work of female-led NGOs in Muslim societies, claiming to liberate Muslim women through wars. For example, there are now hundreds of so-called civil society organizations with 550 political parties and 125 foreign security companies in Iraq. But the conditions are worsening, especially for women. Also, since 1995, numerous national and international conferences concerning Muslim women were held, but I do not see a Muslim woman movement. The few scholar activists like myself who are struggling are scattered geographically and linguistically and disjointed by nationalistic, sectarian, and ethnic or intellectual affiliations. Even when we recognize that disagreement in interpretation is one of Islam's core principles, that helped develop a vast civilization for about 1,000 years, it is not reassuring to read the same traditional material on the website of nearly 50 different organizations speaking in the name of Muslim women, because it makes me realize why none of these organizations is strong enough to be able to stand up and state, for example, that the action of the scholar Amina Wadood, who led a co-educational congregational prayer in 2005, was justified by the Quran. The reality is that the woman who lost her identity or moral autonomy with Islam for centuries will not emerge as an emancipated woman unless she admits that she was not actually practicing Islam, but an interpretation of it that was done by others. The second reason is that Muslims have lost the ability to directly relate the message of the Quran to its principle of keeping Quranic interpretation open in time and place, wherein each individual bears a responsibility and a right, as stated in the first order of the Quran. The Quran states, "Read in the name of God, who created a human of cloth. Read, God is most generous, the teacher who taught by the pen." Yet the majority of Muslims are not considering or practicing the value of self-identity and self-governance as part of the Islamic ethos. By using one tradition that's attributed to the Prophet to emphasize the extreme seclusion of women behind the head cover, which is mistakenly called hijab, or behind a curtain in a mosque, for instance, Muslims, particularly women, are ignoring the basic teaching of the Quran concerning modesty that does not necessarily require covering the hair nor separating men and women. Third and last, some Western feminists co-opted our work and insisted on categorizing it as quote-unquote Islamic feminism, something that I reject because the two terms contradict each other philosophically and on their knowledge base. Feminism is a creative theory intended to regain women's right and place in society by mainly analyzing the social construct of gender as the unit of analysis from a secular perspective. Islam, on the other hand, is a universal worldview that propagates a single pair, the human pair of a male and a female, with equal rights and responsibilities, spiritually, intellectually, and socially, in trusteeship and leadership. The unit of analysis for Quranic interpretation is what the Quran means by the word taqwa, or equilibrium. Each individual, it means, is responsible for building his or her own capacity to balance all these roles in a specific time and at a specific place within the guidelines of the Quran. To summarize, Muslims or non-Muslims have become more conservative in response to the challenges from within and from without. From within, the current religious rights advocates and governing authorities in Muslim and non-Muslim countries are collaborating because they feel threatened by the new interpretations, despite the fact that so-called moderate or progressive groups are still weak in vision, organization, and strategies. Scholars' isolation is also blinded by the thought that it is enough to solve some social issues, even when they are not necessarily specific to Muslim women, such as literacy, education, and domestic violence. They do not see that the situation requires a change in perception and attitude on the ground in order to combat the ignorance among the public who succumb to political corruption or brainwashing. From without, ideas of reforming Muslim societies modeled after European Enlightenment or the American concept of democracy are creating further dichotomy between religious and civil affairs, causing populist unrest directed toward those who are different, instead of self-reflecting and focusing on changing corrupt systems, dogmatism, and ignorance. Western governments and private corporations complicate matters more by supporting dictatorships in Muslim countries and male leaderships in order to protect their own interests, producing further reactionary response by religious extremists on both sides, who misuse weak traditions to propagate their own ends. Hence, the struggle will be difficult, long, and uncertain, but we, Muslim women scholar activists, few as we are, continue to lead the path by rethinking the Quranic message in the same prophetic spirit of tolerating people's needs in time and place. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum. Yes, I'm very happy to take any question. Okay, yes, Art, please, go ahead.
Nama, is there a movement worldwide or in the U.S. to redefine or to update the Hadith, separate from the Quran, but the Hadith? Is there a revised version of some sort?
Well, not yet. That's what this is. Keep looking for my next book. And by the way, my book, Woman's Identity and the Quran, a New Reading, is available in the campus store. And the campus store made special effort to bring some extra copies for those who are interested. I'm not advertising, but just for your information. Thank you for the question. Yes. Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Is Ali's book and her works helpful to reinterpreting the Quran?
Well, in a way, she is, in her own right, trying to do whatever she could. In other way, unfortunately, she puts her personal experience before her specific before the specific guidance of how to interpret the Quran. So that's the one thing, if I see her, I would like to speak with her about. Yes,
like
ma'am. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm hopeful that you're writing the book, but I'm not familiar with it, I must say, that are making some headway, making some impact. You have the feeling that, have you gotten feedback and so on
Yes, the book was published in 2005, and I have received at least 20 reviews, all positive. And they mainly by scholars, Muslims or non-Muslims, who are well known in the field. But the main point, which is I will hope to try to avoid in the next book, is that a little bit too academic for the general reader. And therefore, what I've done is that I translated it into Arabic, and with the help of a translator, of course, though my native language is Arabic, but because the thinking of the subject was done in English, it requires someone who is well-versed in the translation back and forth. And when the publisher in Damascus, which is my native town, wanted to publish it, after reading the introduction in translation, they were afraid to publish it. They said it was too radical. So I decided to take the permission from the University Press of Florida, the original publisher, and put the translation on my website. So for those who do not read English, and you know someone who reads Arabic and want to learn about that book, it is available in its totality on my website, which is easy to locate through Google. So, and I tried to simplify the language a little bit for the general reader, not to make it too academic. So that's a hope.
Book in Arabic is on the website, but not...
That's correct.
The English version is not on the website.
No, it is, however, available electronically to all Cornell community. The library and the provost, thanks the provost, who made a special effort to request that special permission for Cornell community to have the book available electronically, as well as there are a few copies, paper copies. Hard copies, that was the original translation, and the paperback copies that was published in 2007 also available in the library. Yes? I'm hoping that this recording of it by Cornelcast will go on Cornelcast. Now, the text, I usually don't give it right away because there are many corrections along the way. Even when I'm reading it, I'm making corrections. And I like it to be as best as possible before it's given. But I will be happy in the long run. Maybe we could share that. Now I come to your question. Well, I thank you for your question and for your generous offer. Yes, every one of you could help when they hear someone talking about Islam to tell them, what is your source? Just ask them, what is your source? Where are you getting your information? Just to have them question the knowledge that is, or the information that being passed, how accurate it is. Thank you. Yes, Nancy. Now, there is no true interpretation. Nobody could claim there is true interpretation. Otherwise, I would not be standing here. There is the message of the Quran intact in the book itself, which has been intact for the past 14 centuries, never been altered. If you want to read the Quran and it is in its translation, simple translation, the simplest one for the Western mind is the copy by Dawood, that's translation into English. The rendering of the Arabic that is in originally, I mean, the rendering of the Quran that's originally in Arabic, in English, the simplest one is in Dawood. There is also the translation by Muhammad Asad. However, Muhammad Asad translation has a lot of commentary, and that could be confusing. So the simplest, just main translation of the original text of the Arabic text of the Quran is in the last name, Dawood. Now I forgot his first name, but you'll find it in the campus store. Yes?
Can you tell me a lot about religious thought or religious documents? Are people cherry pick what they want out of them, and then they say, well, this statement is in the Quran, this statement is in the Bible, and sure enough it is, but it's totally taken out of context. And it's very difficult for us in the West to understand the context of any of these things. I mean, some things we hear that are in the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know exactly how to fight that, except by reading.
Yes, and that's why I suggested to our friend here that ask them, what is your source? And if it is the Quran, then tell them, read me that verse and what was the context of the verse and where did it occur? Because that's exactly the problem with Orientalism, because they have been interpreting the Quran in piecemeal, or what is called automating the Quran. The same thing, unfortunately, Muslims the past 200, 300 years have been following the same methodology, not paying attention to the totality of the Quran, and it is a simple message. It is a very simple message, believing in no deity but God. As simple as that. So I cannot even accept my husband's interpretation, even though it might be better than mine, because I'm responsible for my own understanding of how I fully and responsibly apply that particular teaching in the Quran. That's as close as it comes. Yes. Yes, my brother Qasim.
My question would be that so far we have a lot of historical habit of understanding Quran through male dominance. And when you try to add to it and female understanding of Quran through still would not have it from that point. So is there a way to get to the context of the Quran without being made of faith?
Well, that's exactly what I said. When you follow the rules of interpreting the Quran, then it doesn't matter what male or female. However, because males have been dominating this interpretation and limiting, not accepting women's interpretation for 14 centuries, it is time that we mainstream whatever female scholars' interpretation in as part of the thought, the Islamic thought. That has not happened yet. This is the basic problem that I'm talking. Yes, it does matter in certain issues where male and female perspective differ, and we need to take that into account. Yet from Quranic principles of interpretations, there is no difference whether it's male or female. It matters that they are following the same basic principles of interpretations with an open heart and open mind, not retrieving back to their prior knowledge of what this sheikh said or that imam said. That's what matters. They have to rethink that process from point zero. Is that? Yes, we have to try, even if we may not. One more question?
The ending, but I just wondered if it sounds like it's so difficult to get the female perspective to the Arabic world in Arabic. I mean, what you're saying is they won't publish things if you want to publish in Arabic. Is there some? How does this work get around that?
Well, the power of the internet is really doing a good job. I've been receiving a lot of questions from all over through the emails, which is probably they did me a favor by not publishing it. Because, and that's another sad part in the Muslim and Arab world, that same publishing company that published my earlier edited book in 1996, I had an edited volume called Muslim Identity and the Struggle for Justice. It was also translated by the same publishing company. They told me that about maybe 20 years ago, they used to publish 100,000 copies. They are well known in the Arab world, they are. So they sell and distribute all over. When they were translating my book, they only published 1,000 copies because nobody is reading. This is the saddest part. So, of course, they had to consider the monetary thing, but at the same time, they were so afraid and scared to publish my book because, unfortunately, exactly the same thing that I stated earlier. They take only, because I critiqued one of the prophetic tradition that being not authentic, even though it is in a collection that's revered by many Muslims, they said that I was too radical. So that's the status of Muslim mind. They are not willing to accept to the idea of free thinking, let alone the process of free thinking.
But at least you're on the internet now, so
that's the hope. The hope is with the young generation, like some of the young generations who are here today. This is the hope with them. They have to really start standing up to their right as individual, autonomous, responsible people who have the right to rethink Islam.